I have the third verse up here yet. Fourth verse. Oh, we're not doing the. Okay, good. Got this. Let's make sure it's the right version. That looks good. All right, I'm going to stop the share, but it's going to be there when we need it. That's so that everybody doesn't have to have.
Hey, Namdok.
Hey, Namdok.
Hey, Deidre. Hi, Llama.
Hi,
Val. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Namdok. I was muted. I say hi.
Actually, we could read your lips. All right, oh, it's 1:02. We'll give, no, let's not give anybody more time. Let's do the prayers. That way we don't fall behind. Dan, did I send you the prayer sheet, and do you have it, or?
I have my own copy already.
Okay, great, alrighty. We're gonna do the prayers to be recited at teachings, the first four prayers, and then I do some teacher prayers. Oh, I'm going to meet everybody. Hold on a sec. I manage participants. Okay, you are all now muted, and you can unmute yourself at will. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, may roof or continent, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. And now my teacher prayers for Dharmas of Gampopa. Dhanan sem chen tam che lo su chu dro lo chu su dro ar zin ji lab tu sol chu lam du dro ar zin ji lab tu sol lam trilpa sel ar zin ji lab tu sol trilpa ye she su char ar zin ji lab tu sol. I pray for blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. And from the aspiration to excellent conduct. In the tongue, lai ke dang lu dang nu chin ke, chulvum dadami, ke nam dang, droa kunji drake jitsam par, tam shi ke du daki chitendo. In the tongues of nagas, yakshas, gods, those of humans and of demons too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. See. And we're going to do, if you have the Bodhi Chitta sheet. I know Dan does not have the Bodhicitta sheet. I don't think I've sent that to him yet, but I will do that. We can all recite our Bodhicitta together. And traditionally, Dan, it's just recited by the teacher. So you're not really missing out today. You're doing it in the traditional way, anybody who doesn't have the sheet. But I thought it would be nice for us all to recite it together. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. And this is exactly what the 37 practices of a bodhisattva is about. It's about arousing this motivation and putting it into practice through study, study, contemplation, and meditation. So does anybody have any, are there any technical questions or technical updates? John, is there anything that you need to say about technology? Okay, we're all good then. Anybody have any questions on anything before we do the meditation? And again, you can unmute yourself whenever you need to. And there is like a mechanism for raising your hand so that I see a note on my screen. And John sent the instructions to that, only Dan did not get those yet. But he probably can't do it on his phone anyway. We'll let the siren go by. I don't know if you can hear it. Can you see okay? Like I can see this brightness coming in from my window. Is that like interfering with your viewing pleasure? Okay, great. So we're going to do the two wings of awakening. And again, Dan, I don't think I've sent you this. Oh, good. Okay, fabulous. Nobody actually needs the sheet because I do it as a guided meditation. But if you would like to read along as we do it, that's fine. And welcome to Kathy. So we'll begin. This is like meditation. So we will begin by checking in with our posture and our body and just letting ourselves ease into full presence in the present moment of awareness. Making sure basically that our spine is straight, our body is well grounded, the feet on the floor or, you know, the seat on the cushion in the, you know, in the posture, cross-legged posture, giving us a very stable position. Hands can be palms down on the knees or thighs, or they can be in the meditation mudra. I know everybody knows that one. Shoulders are slightly squared, not slumping. Chin is just ever so slightly inclined towards the Adam's apple to keep the neck straight. We check in with our jaw, our tongue, our mouth, because we hold a lot of tension there. We use it a lot in talking and just relax. And our gaze, with regard to the gaze, we can either do the traditional open-eyed gaze with the eyes slightly open and just looking in an unfocused way down towards whatever is in front of us. Or we can have eyes closed if that's helps the experience. And in this posture, we just briefly check in with our body. We're not going to do a point-by-point body scan, but you can always do that. Just get a sense of your whole body, like coming out of your head into your body. What does it feel like to be sitting on this seat? In the space that you're in this present moment of awareness, and just rest in that for a moment. And then we contemplate the four thoughts. That's the preliminary section of the two wings of awakening. Remembering the precious human existence, which is the first verse of the 37 practices. Just really in a heartfelt way appreciating this amazing opportunity that we have because of all the freedoms and resources that we bring to the situation and the resources that come from outside that are hard to find. Just really feeling a sense of gratitude and appreciation. And then remembering impermanence and death, that it's all going to come to an end any minute now, or hopefully years down the road, and we'll have time to practice. We don't know. But it's a limited time opportunity, so we really need to use it now and not put it off. Just letting that sink in. And then the fourth thought, karma, that it's our own actions that determine our fate, whether our future is filled with happiness, suffering, or liberation. All depends on what we do in this lifetime. So we want to direct our actions according to the result that we want. Letting that sink in. And then the fourth thought, the suffering of samsara, in case we have any idea that maybe we could just get a better situation in samsara by doing our dharma practice. there's no safe place in samsara. So our motivation needs to be to completely liberate ourselves from all aspects of samsara, from all belief that our experiences, our worldly experiences, our desires and hopes and fears and aversions and all that can bring us any kind of lasting happiness, and turn our attention instead towards really freeing ourselves so that we can also free other beings. Again, with each of these, we can let our mind rest for a moment without thinking further about it, but just letting it sink into our being. And then we prepare ourselves for the main practice, again, still part of the preliminary, by just bringing our mind that little bit further to rest by engaging in a moment or two of calm abiding meditation. You can count 7 breaths on the each out breath, or you can just follow the breath, just bringing the mind, the attention to focus. And then while in this focused resting state, we're going to do the 4 steps, the cultivation of wisdom, ultimate bodhicitta. First, look at all experience as a dream. So however vivid our experience of this present moment and whatever led up to it may be, whatever worries we may have about the future after this class, whatever thoughts and judgments and opinions we may be adhering to, we just allow the space that it could be the same as a dream, equally ephemeral, equally not really true or solid. And we rest in that for a moment. Again, it's a feeling, like what would it feel like if this were a dream? And then when you're at home, if you do this at home, you can take as long as you want for each step, but it really only takes a moment. You just sort of tune in and then you can go to the next step. The next one is examine the nature of awareness, which is unborn, has no beginning. And that means we turn our attention inward, away from seeing all experience as a dream, though we don't need to lose that, but we now turn inward and look at the mind itself, which is experiencing our experience as a dream. And we just look for the mind, like, where is it? It's not an analytical process, but we do ask ourselves some questions to help us tune into being present with the mind. Where is it located? Does it have a location? If you feel it has a location, could it be located somewhere else? Would you make the location move? Does mind have a color or a shape? Just resting in that looking. And we're told by all of the great masters that we find that it doesn't have any of these things. We can't locate any characteristics in mind itself. And so that's what we call the remedy to seeing our experience as solid. And the third step is to let go of even the remedy. Let the remedy release naturally. So that means let go of any thoughts or conclusions we may have come to. And that brings us directly and immediately into the fourth step. Rest in the essence, the basis of everything. We don't have to know what those words mean. It just means to let go of all thoughts, let go of even seeing our experience as a dream or seeing our mind as emptiness, and just rest. Trungpa Rinpoche calls it home sweet home. I'm going to rest in home sweet home for a moment. Home sweet home is the essence of all our experience. It's what we call the nature of the mind, rooted nature. It's the mind without, the mind that's free of concepts, free of concepts, free of distraction, free of trying to make it be a particular way, just resting as it is. And having touched base with this wisdom of the nature of mind, we now cultivate relative bodhicitta or compassion through taking and sending, which again we'll do briefly here, but at home you can do it as much as you want. The slogan from the 7 points of mind training is practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. And we're going to do it today first for ourselves. If we have any emotional disturbance, any tension, any anxiety, anything that's disturbing our peace of mind, whether it be physical or emotional, we breathe that in. Just breathe in that and the discomfort that it's causing. Breathe it in and right into our vast heart center, the nature of our mind, our Buddha nature, and let it dissolve along with the breath. And then breathe out to ourself whatever we need, the antidote to any emotional disturbance or feeling, peace, relaxation, joy, happiness. Don't have to define it. We know what it is. And we'll do that for a few rounds, breathing in our own distress, disturbance, dissolving it, breathing out whatever we need to ourselves. If we don't have any distress or discomfort, we can just rest in equanimity. And now we will expand our visualization still, including ourselves, but now including everyone else who's present here in the class with us, wherever they may be. Whatever distress, tension, discomfort, pain anyone may be having, we don't need to know what it is, but we breathe it in from everyone into our vast Buddha nature where we let it dissolve. And we breathe out to everyone whatever they need. Don't have to know what it is, just through the intention it happens automatically. Now let's include anyone who's died recently. In our Richmond Sangha, we've had several deaths related to our Sangha in the last couple of weeks. So we'll breathe in the distress, anxiety, fear, all emotional affliction of anyone who is in the bardo right now. Maybe we know someone specifically and we can think of them, or just including everyone in the bardo. whatever distress we're breathing in, we're not holding on to it. It doesn't have any effect on us. We're simply letting it dissolve into our breathing nature. And now expanding our visualization to the max, including all sentient beings on this planet, on all planets throughout the universe, above ground, below ground, in the oceans, in outer space, breathing in all the distress of all beings, dissolving it, breathing out whatever they need, which could include relaxation, peace, freedom from fear, happiness, awakening. And before we let go of this taking and sending visualization, let's take a moment to make sure we're still in touch with that nature of mind, that vast open awareness, that essence of all experience. So we can be in touch with that even as we do other things. And now we end the meditation by thinking that we and all sentient beings are now completely free from all suffering, completely filled with happiness, relaxation, and freedom, and all have attained the state of complete and perfect Buddhahood. Feeling what that feels like. And now letting go of all visualization and all concepts, just resting by following our breath or resting in open awareness. And now gradually letting ourselves come back to the kind of awareness we need to engage in the class, but still not losing touch with our Buddha nature, that vast awareness, the essence of everything that we do, say, and feel, and think. We can always tune into that. So feel free to stretch or take a moment, have a sip of water. Looks like it's hot in Key West. Getting my papers in order here. So anybody have any questions about the meditation or anything that they would like to say before we launch into today's subject matter? All right, and again, you can unmute yourself if you do have something to say, or you can use the nifty raise hand technique to give me a note. Okay, silent pop quiz. Instead of going over the basic orientation to the text today, I thought I would just ask everybody to bring it to mind silently. And if you can't quite do that, then you might want to make a point of just studying it a little bit. Who wrote the 37 practices? Any name will do of his four names. If you can put all four of them together, it's like extra bonus brownie points. And what century did he live in? So the answer, which I'm sure everybody got, was, let's see if I can do it, Jalse Mulchu Tokme Zangpo. We call him Tokme Zangpo, excellent Asanga, and he lived in the 14th century along with Dante and Chaucer and the Black Death in Europe. He was not in Europe. He had a completely different set of experiences. Okay, next silent pop quiz. which is the one we always have at the beginning of class. What are the first three practices of a bodhisattva? And not the verse, but just the name. It's really great if we can just keep that going, that list. So the first one, to study, contemplate, and meditate. Second one, to leave your homeland. And the third one, to rely on solitude. And those are the official names. Sometimes there's some more information in the verse, or one translation might have a substitute, like Ken McLeod says, rely on silence instead of rely on solitude, but we're going with the classic list. Okay, so I'm going to do my screen sharing thing. So in case anybody does not have the current list practices, of verses, and we're going to chant the first three verses together. And we're going to talk today more about the third one, because I think it's really a challenge for us as Western people in the 21st century. All right, so again, you're all muted. It's because we can't have different audio coming in from different places because it skews everything. But we'll all hear our own voice, and I guess mine. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat, to navigate samsara's endless sea and set myself and other beings free. For that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To give up all my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in Dharma dawns and thrives. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And before I stop the screen share, let's do the third one more time. And really, as we're chanting it, try to be connected with the meaning as we go on. That's actually hard to do. Try to keep the meaning going. It's like staying in touch with vast open awareness when we're in the midst of activity. We're kind of doing two things at one time with our attention, but our intention is like infinite. So as we chant, I'm going to chant it a little slower this time, and let's just really try to keep the meaning in mind. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my Dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in Dharma dawns and thrives. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. I hope that went okay for everybody. So last week we talked about, and I wrote on my blog about seeing this as a sequence. We remove ourselves from emotional disturbance. We remove ourselves from distraction, and we can do this on a daily basis just by going to our meditation corner. And, you know, not being interrupted for that short space of time. So we actually isolate ourselves from distractions and disturbances. And just by doing that, it's a chain reaction that leads all the way to awakening. Like, solitude is the first domino. And I guess, you know, like this is like the dominoes fallen. I guess that's all right. But the dominoes of samsaric entanglement fall automatically if you just tip the solitude one. So we got into our meditation space. We got into our posture. And what happens then is like there's nothing else to do. Really, we could engage in thinking, but it would defeat the purpose. Like, why would we even be sitting there? So we already have the resolution that we're actually going to isolate not only our body, but our mind from thoughts and the hubbub of the day and all that. Nothing else to do. What do you fill that space with? If we're a Dharma practitioner, we know the drill. Like, it's just, we do our practice. Whether it's Shine, whether it's Chinrezig, whether it's Lundro, whether it's Laji, we do our practice. And it fills up the space that normally is occupied by all these 10 million things that we have to deal with or that we're sucked in by all day long. And that's like in a mini, like a fractal domino set, let's say, you know, the solitude tips over into Dharma practice happening of its own accord because we've created a vacuum for it to flourish. And through doing that, our awareness, which I called awareness knowing Rigpa, and I'll explain that again. We talked about it a little bit last week. That clarifies our mind. Our awareness becomes clearer through letting our attention go to our Dharma practice, our full attention as best we can. That automatically starts to clarify our awareness, to develop our awareness. And then through developing that awareness, we see the certainty. We see with certainty the truth of the Buddhist teachings, the Dharma, like this is the way it is. Impermanence, yes. Precious human existence, yes. Karma, yes. Suffering of samsara, yes. And what that does, and again, I talked about this in my blog. I don't know if people have had a chance to read the latest update because I was very late getting to it this week, but it creates a different cycle. Like right now with our samsaric minds, all of us included, me too, we're naturally attracted to the stuff that digs us in deeper, the emotional reactivity, the distractions, the busyness. And it's just, there's our cycle of samsara. That's it. As Lama Norley used to say, it's like laundry going around in the dryer. It just automatically, you start the sequence and it just goes. You give in to distraction. It just goes. Distraction, confusion, suffering. And then you distract yourself from the suffering with distraction, confusion, suffering, and it just goes round and round. But we have, with a little initiative, by just isolating ourselves from all that for a few minutes or however long we can, we create a different cycle. And that's what this verse describes, is the cycle of isolating ourselves from distraction and disturbance, Dharma practice, awareness becoming more clear, and then seeing the truth of Dharma. And then through that, we automatically want to go around that circle again. You want to do more Dharma practice, so you want to isolate yourself some more. You know, it might be within a single session, like you were going to do 5 minutes, but you're not ready to get up. Like you kind of completed that loop. You're not ready to get up, so maybe you do 10 minutes or half an hour, maybe. Or just the next day, you go, yeah, I really need to get away from this. I need to just disentangle myself. And so you go, like, it becomes a positive habit, a positive impulse. It really, that's merit. That's what merit is, creating positive momentum towards awakening. Because just by stopping the other stuff that normally sucks us in so much, we've made space for sort of the positive momentum to grow and propel itself. And I can tell you from 37 years of personal experience with this, I've certainly had my ups and downs with consistency and motivation and all that, but it really happens like that. This verse is absolutely true. So all we have to do, like our only job, is to make that space in our life every day if we can. If you miss a day, just forget that you missed it and go on the next day as if you didn't miss a day. Don't let yourself get into a pattern of missing a day and then going, oh crap, I can't really do this. I'm too busy or whatever. Just like you miss a day, you miss 2 days, the third day, jump on it. It really works. It absolutely works. And that leads me into, and again, you can unmute yourself if you have any questions or comments, and I will provide some spaces specifically for discussion coming up. But I wanted to place this in the context of all seven of the preliminary verses. So when we looked at the textual outline near the beginning of Dingo Chensei's book in like the second class, we saw that he divides the 37 verses or practices into sections, and they are a particular part of the path. So it functions, again, as a lamrim, as a guide to the whole path of awakening in just 37 verses. So the first seven practices are what he calls the preparation or the preliminaries. And we're very familiar with this idea of preliminaries. We've all been on the Dharma path for a while. So these first seven are the run-up to the actual path. Like before you can actually set foot onto the path itself and engage in the actual practice effectively, we have to build up these preliminaries. So you have to go through this process of the preliminaries. So they form an interesting pattern as well. It's worth like noticing and thinking about, because they're not like, it's not like each verse is like a separate thing. You know, we're looking at some real interdependence here. The first verse gives us like an overview of the entire, like what does a bodhisattva do? Well, a bodhisattva does study, contemplation, and meditation on the Buddha's teachings. That's the whole book in one verse. That's the whole overview of what we're doing. The rest of the book is sort of how to do that. The preliminaries are like how to do that. And then the rest of the book is like the content of it. So first verse is the overview of everything. And then the next three verses, second practice, third, fourth, and fifth, the next four practices of the seven preliminaries are, as Pema Chödrön says in her, you know, it said in her commentary, they're about disentangling ourselves. So before we can effectively engage in the practice of a bodhisattva, first we have to turn away from samsara. Like same purpose as the four thoughts. So we have to like extricate ourselves from this quicksand that we're in that's sucking all of our attention and energy before we can really turn our attention to the path itself, to engaging in these practices, these core practices. So the first step of that is to recognize what the quicksand consists of. So the second verse is about leaving our homeland. So we've resolved to study, contemplate, and meditate. How do we actually do that? First, we have to start to disengage from all of our habitual reactivity that keeps us from turning our attention to the Dharma. So that's about attachment and aversion and indifference. And then so we recognize then that that's what we need to do. But how do you actually do it? Like verse 2 doesn't tell us how to do it. It just tells us what we need to do. So first step, overview. Second step, this is what you have to do. Third step, third verse is how to take the first step out, which is to isolate yourself, to find a way to have some solitude, some isolation away from all the stuff that sucks us into samsara on a moment-to-moment basis. We need to pull ourselves out of emotionally disturbing situations. We need to let go of all the distractions and turn our mind actually to the Dharma. So that's the third step. And then, so that's how far we've gotten. We're still busy disentangling ourselves, and we're going to talk more about that third verse today because it is such a key. I think that is the hardest thing for all of us. Like once you can get a routine in place of actually doing Dharma practice every day and turning your mind to Dharma in the midst of difficult situations, it unfolds. Like it just does itself. The rest takes care of itself. But that is such a hard thing for us to do as Westerners, there's so many distractions and so many busy things that we must take care of. So, really, genuinely, so many things to take care of, just owning a house, you know, having a job, having a family. Dan's still with us. Good. Is Clementine down? Did she go for her nap? Oh, not quite yet. Having a family is a big, like, distraction. Even 1 2-year-old can totally derail your Dharma practice. Only if you can keep your mind turned towards the Dharma, it is your Dharma practice. And I can speak from experience on that one, too, and I bet Dan can as well. So the third one's really hard. So we're spending 2 weeks on it. And I don't know that we won't spend more time on some of the other ones too. I don't think they'll all need 2 weeks. But Marilyn emailed me this week and said, you know, from my point of view, we don't really have to like finish a verse every week. And I took that as encouragement. If anybody disagrees, please email me. But anyway, so just to give you the preview of the rest of the 7 preliminaries, the next two are still disentangling ourselves. The fourth verse, which I've put up on my blog already, is to let go of attachment to this lifetime. It's basically impermanence, the recognition of impermanence. We're going to lose our friends and loved ones eventually, later if not sooner. We're going to lose everything that we have accumulated in life, every single thing. We're going to leave it behind when we die, if we don't lose it some other way before in a big recession or whatever. And we're going to even lose our body. The consciousness is going to say goodbye to the body when it's time to go, when we've worn out the body, or when the bus is coming in our direction, whatever it is. I'm glad Jeffrey didn't join us today. I use that example unthinkingly sometimes. So letting go of, like, right, remembering impermanence and letting go of every attachment that we have in this life. That's another disentanglement that we have to do. And another thing that just sucks our attention and energy is just being attached to things. The fifth one is letting go of friends, giving up friends or avoiding friends or not getting too entangled with friends who lead us off the path. And we'll talk about that when we get to it. Doesn't mean we have to like slam the door in their face, but you just don't let them distract you. And we all have friends who are happy to pull us away. Maybe some of them don't even like approve of what we're doing, so they want to like free us up from our cult or whatever. But, you know, I mean, just the phone call, like let's go out to dinner or, you know, whatever it is. Let's eat a gallon of ice cream together. Let's binge watch something. To a point, it's fine. It's not saying you have to slam the door in their face, but we just have to recognize and not get sucked in again and again, distracted again and again. So those are the five about disentanglement. Like the first one's really just setting the scene. Next four are about disentanglement. But then the last two, with five, we've disentangled ourselves. Like we've covered the bases of our samsaric entanglement. And 5 and 6 are looking towards the path now. The fifth one is about relying on a spiritual teacher and your spiritual community. And the sixth one is about who do you go for refuge to? The Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And with that, you complete the preliminaries. You've disentangled yourself. It's all a work in progress, of course, but you've got all of those ideas in place. And now you're looking, you've got the things you need, the spiritual teacher, and the refuge. And if you're familiar with the Ornament of Precious Liberation, aka the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, same basic sequence. Like impermanence, for example, Gampopa doesn't put into the preliminaries. He has 3 prerequisites for starting the path, and impermanence is not one of those. It happens to be part of the path for him, but it's still all the same. It's all the same advice, all the same instructions. So when you're learning these verses, studying these verses, contemplating these verses, see that sequence. Like be aware of like what the purpose is and how the verses are working together to achieve this result of disentangling ourselves from samsara and setting out on the path to awakening in a very definite, resolved way. This takes effort, as I said as we discussed last week, and I you know, and I said in my blog update. So we're going to go back to the commentary. Does anybody have anything they would like to say right now or ask? Deidre.
Yeah, about the sitting on the cushion and meditation, which of course is really the best way to get the ball rolling. But I found that lately my mind really needs to stretch and go out and walk. Mm-hmm. And sometimes for me, I'm finding that open spaciousness being outside and actually being more in touch with that Buddha nature feeling. So I just want to add that. I know we're all walkers. I know you are, Kathy, as I am. And I know Rinpoche has said that the mind needs different things at different times. So it for me, it's not always on the cushion, although I do spend a little time every day doing that. But then also sometimes I know I'm actually too distracted in the house that I have to get out and stretch.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Yes, I agree. I do some of my mental and physical isolation outside too, walking. It's a really good way sometimes to get that isolation and just disentangle yourself from the day to day. And it does have that sense of spaciousness. You know, the sky, you're under the sky, it's a very different feeling. And sometimes it's easier to connect, I think, with the present moment in that way. Anybody else have anything? So we're going to go through the commentary again. I will skip little bits of it, but as I've said a few times now, it's worth reading this particular verse commentary in Dingo Chenzi Rinpoche again and again. It's just very, very tightly packed with amazing observations and advice about disentanglement, about isolating ourselves, about relying on solitude. And we're gonna have discussion of several points as time permits along the way here. So on page 65, if you have the book, he has his Padmakara Translation Committee's translation here of the verse. And he says, when you live in a solitary place. So here, you know, he's talking, we've left our homeland. And in 14th century Tibet, that was a pretty literal instruction. It was still about giving up all of your habits and your attachments and your aversions and your routines and all that. But they achieved it by... maybe they couldn't achieve it by staying in the tent with the whole family all the time. I don't know. They went to the monastery or they went to the cave. They went to the place. So they physically isolated themselves. They physically left their homeland. So for us, when you live in a solitary place, we can think when you go to your meditation place. When you live in a solitary place, your negative emotions gradually diminish and your self-control, or we could say discipline, and moderation increase. And then he has the lovely verse, which I'm going to read again. I read it last week on the next page. This is also from Tokne Zanpo, but it's not in the 37 practices. In a solitary place, and again, this is incorporating both verse 2 and verse 3 here. It's like about leaving the homeland and being in a solitary place. In a solitary place, there are no enemies to defeat, no relatives to protect, no superiors or bosses to look up to, no servants or employees to be looked after. So, apart from taming your mind, what else will you have to do there, Mani reciters? And that's exactly what the verse itself says. Get rid of the disturbances, get rid of the distractions, and there's nothing else to do. If you're a Dharma practitioner, recite Manis. That's what you do when you have a chance. So we're giving ourselves the chance for creating the opportunity. And that's the key. We got to create it. We have to take actual steps to make this happen because it will not happen on its own. So I'm going to skip down to the bottom of the page to the first discussion point. We brought this up last week, but didn't really have time to discuss it. Hi, Fanny. If you wish to concentrate entirely on the Dharma instead of being constantly tossed hither and thither by waves of attachment and aversion, give them up and go to a solitary place. So going to a solitary place is the way to achieve the goal of a Dharma practitioner, which is to be free from the emotional turmoil of the five emotional poisons. What I think we need to ask ourselves, and I think this is where there's an obstacle for a lot of us, is it really what we want? Like, do we look forward to going to that cushion? Do we really want to not be emotionally engaged, like in the sense of being sucked into things? Or do we get something out of being sucked into things? And I'm going to throw out the example of, and I've done this. I mean, I don't watch many sports things, but every once in a while I might be in a place, you know, somebody's watching a basketball game or whatever. And I used to be a big baseball fan in my youth. I went to baseball games at the local stadium and so forth. And so if you find yourself watching a sports event, maybe you're watching Wimbledon. What if you watched it and you didn't care who won? Like, you just watched it as like an interesting thing unfolding, and you could remove the emotional engagement, like the being upset if your favorite person loses, or just really, really wanting your favorite person to win. What if you take that out of the equation? Because that's what we're talking about here. That's exactly what we're talking about. What if when watching a movie, like a really good movie, you know how movies, like one of the things about movies is that they take you out of your life and you're in somebody else's life, and their emotional poisons and emotional turmoil are unfolding, and we identify with it. Like, that's, in some ways, that's where the enjoyment of the movie comes, right? So what if we took ourselves out of that? What if we can disengage? And as we're watching it and enjoying the story and the spectacle of the movie, we don't get sucked into the emotions. We remember these people are fictional characters. Like, this is not really happening to this person. So you don't get devastated when the person gets shot or whatever. But you just go, okay, you know, that's the next thing that happened. So I'm just throwing that out there. Like, if anybody has anything they would like to share, I don't know if you had a chance to think about that during the week. Do we really want our lives? Do we really want equanimity? Is that really what we want? Because if we don't want it, it's going to be very hard to be a Dharma practitioner. I would love to hear from anybody who has a thought on this, but it's optional as always. And you don't have to speak to your own motivation, you know, just any general observations are fine too. Those are mine. You've heard mine. Oh, Kathy, I can unmute you. All right, you're unmuted.
It's kind of interesting because I've been dealing with family health issues, you know, serious ones. And it's very curious as you, I find the longer I'm in the Dharma, the less emotional I am. And it's really, it's a very nice place to be in equanimity, to not be, I think you can be a lot more helpful to people. And when things happen, you don't get thrown off so much. It's, but on the other hand, you kind of have to be careful because people expect a bigger reaction sometimes. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you kind of have to watch that.
Right.
But it's been really interesting. And not to say that it isn't exhausting and emotional and all of that, but yeah.
But are you back at home now?
I am back at home. So, yeah. So I'm kind of on the crash dead.
Does that mean that your friend died, or did you just have to come home?
No, I came home to take care of stuff here, and I'll probably go back in less than a month, actually. So, yeah.
Yeah. So I think you bring up a good point. I think there's, like, when we talk about disengaging, like not being involved in the sense of attachment and aversion, we're not going to that third poison, which is indifference. Like the second talks about that. It's not indifference or lack of engagement. But I think you're right. People sometimes expect an emotional reaction that maybe we don't feel so much once we've been practicing the Dharma for a while. But yeah. I mean, I never felt like, say, from Lama Norla or any of the teachers, like you could go to them with a problem or a situation or something, or there could be something happening right then, and they don't get sucked into the emotion of it. But they're right. Not all disengaged. Mm-mm. They're engaging in it from a point of view of wisdom and compassion, of equanimity, of, as you said, being able to be there, to really be present and not caught up in emotional reactivity and actually be of service.
Yeah, it's like, right.
Like right. The example that sometimes we hear of, like, you know, like going to the doctor, like the Buddha is the doctor who's, you know, and he gives you the medicine and you take the medicine, but like, you don't want to go to a doctor who's going to go, oh my God, you've cut yourself. You know, you want the doctor to be like laid back, okay, see this every day, no problem, we kind of know the outcome, it's going to be okay, you can put a Band-Aid on it, a few stitches.
Yeah. I'm like the doctor that my friend Donna went to, the orthopedic guy, and her daughter asked, how are, you know, what's the general state of her bones? And the doctor said, well, honestly, they suck. I mean, he actually said that. And of course, we have kind of a wicked sense of humor, so we all laugh. But
yeah.
I mean, you know, that was, it's a trip, I'll tell you. Yeah. This whole thing. So thank you.
It's a balance too. It's just a balance.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
And we're not going to get it right. You know, it's not like you're going to, you know, it's just, it's a learning process. Every situation is a learning process. So we can't think, oh my God, I screwed up again. Like I got sucked in again. It's like, you just learn from it.
Yeah.
And the more you engage, the more you engage from a Dharma point of view, the more the emotional reactivity actually does recede, I think.
And people really appreciate that. You know, my family and friends, you know, it's like you bring a sense of calm to the situation.
Right. And, but it's a warm calm.
Calm. And you don't even realize that this is what you do until you're in the middle of it. And it's like, it's kind of actually that way.
Yeah.
Wow. Pretty good. So
my question is, I guess, what kind of gratification do we get from, like, really going full hog on the emotions, you know, like really giving into anger? And we do it sometimes unconsciously, like we don't have control over it, but we also, it gets fed by our feeling, like when we're angry, like our feeling of self-righteousness and getting the last word, like there's, you get the last word and you just feel so great in that moment. Now I'm right. Sometimes it feels good to hurt somebody's feelings because they've hurt you, to lash back at them. There's this good feeling that happens in that moment. The aftermath, not so good generally. But do we really, like, Deidre, you got something to say?
Yeah, I think there's so much right now out there that is drawing that out in us. You know, look at it, politically speaking, So if two of us that agree on what's going start talking, and three, you watch the crescendo of the emotions going higher and higher. And so in the beginning, I think I was in total shock. And then I think I got involved in the emotions and felt the self-righteousness of, you know, what I'm feeling and looking at and what's happening. And then I started recognizing the doubling down in the bias and also validating my own feeling and starting to look for problems in the other side.
Right.
Rather than looking for anything that they're doing that could possibly be beneficial. And even if there was something, well, it was by mistake somehow that they brought about a benefit. Like now our awareness is much more elevated because of the blatant fact that we're facing of how this person views the world and himself in it. It's become like so obvious that we cannot not see it. So to me, actually, that's kind of a gift, but, you know, trying to give a little credit where credit's due. And
well, I'm going to throw a little wrench into the works there, though, because there's like a lot of people who see it exactly the opposite way, too.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Completely different. I can see,
I feel in some levels that, no, I'm not reacting and doing and buying into the emotions. And then when there is that emotional connection with somebody else on that same level of believing the way we believe, we've come to understand that you, just in talking about it, you actually think something, you're changing something or something's happening when all you're doing is talking.
Right. Well, that was going to, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So I think that yeah, in some regards, I'm willing to let go, but I think that leaving that homeland also has to include that area. You know, that's the hard one, you know.
That was actually my third example, which I didn't say, was like, try to watch a political debate without taking sides. Like, just where's the truth in this? Like, only be interested in where's the truth. And sometimes you surprise yourself because your judgments are so strong that you gloss over. And that's just what you were saying. Sometimes you fail to see the good on the side you don't believe in because you're not rooting for that. You want to see them fail. So, or if, for people on Facebook, like, can you, I mean, I'm on Facebook, but I've like, I hardly have anybody on my newsfeed because I just don't want to see the stuff. But I used to follow some political arguments and stuff. And can you just follow it without getting emotionally involved in it? And the crux of the question, do we want to? Do we want this not to be our life? Do we want equanimity? And we're not going to resolve that question. And it's a different answer, I think, and a different unfolding for everybody. But I think we need to keep that foremost in our minds. If we're having trouble finding time for Dharma practice, I think we need to look at like what our motivation is, because we may be telling ourselves, yes, I want to practice the Dharma. That's my number one priority, is to do my Dharma practice and, you know, and tame my emotions, my strong emotions towards equanimity. And if we're not able to find that time, we might want to wonder if that's what we really want. And if it's not what we really want, we need to think about that. I mean, I don't think there's a right answer or a wrong answer for any individual person. It's like, we just need to be clear about our own path and our own wishes and our own motivation. And I think if we wrestle with ourselves on that, it could remove a lot of obstacles for us. We might have a lot of ambivalence that we're not aware of. I can certainly say that for myself. The motivation is not always 100%. It's like, but I really want to watch this movie or whatever it is. Or it feels, even Pema Chodron talks about that, like how good it feels like to have righteous anger and just keep feeding it. We all struggle with the same things. All right. Oh, Namdok, did you have something to say?
Yeah, I was just going to say that if that's not what we really want, or we're not sure if that's what we really want, then maybe we should put a little more effort in practicing the four practices that turn the mind to the Dharma.
Yeah, that is
the permanence and such. It's a big motivator for me.
Yeah, thanks for adding that. I think that's a very necessary part of the conversation. The four thoughts, or the 37 practices, the preliminaries to the 37 practices also. Like, while those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire, like, does that really feel good? It does in some ways, but in other ways, if we really look at it with a clear mind, I think maybe not so much. But that's something we all have to figure out for ourselves. Yes, Marilyn, I will unmute you.
Well, I'm just thinking from the medical point of view, if you want to separate body from mind, which doesn't really make any sense, but anyhow, the stirring up of, you know, getting your adrenals going and what, all that stuff is really bad for us. I mean, we know it's bad for us. So just from a health point of view, not a religious point of view, but from a health point of view, we know it's bad for us.
Yeah.
It's not good.
Another excellent point. These are things that we can use. We can use the four thoughts. We can use all the list of things in Gampopa's chapter on patience, like the things that you can think about when you're feeling anger towards someone, and you want to cultivate patience. And you can think about the medical impact of anger and even desire, strong desire on one's own health and well-being. These are all helpful. And one time I asked Lama Norla, like a few years ago, what do you do when you, how do you keep your mind relaxed and about doing practice and stay motivated to do practice? And he said, remember the benefits. So we should have that list handy, the four thoughts, the benefits of our practice and so forth. It really, really helps. So thank you everybody for your comments. And this is why we're all together here, because we all have insights that help each other. So I'm going to go on in the commentary. There's a couple of other points I wanted to talk about a little bit, and one of them is right ahead. So if you wish to concentrate entirely on the Dharma, instead of being constantly tossed hither and thither by waves of attachment and aversion, the solution is give them up and go to a solitary place. Just get out of Dodge. And then the next step, turn your mind inward. Identify your defects, rid yourself of them, and develop all your inherent good qualities. But as we see in the verse, that process naturally unfolds, and we're going to see it in other verses too. When we get to like verse 5, we're going to see the same thing. Verse 6, sorry. So I just wanted to point out, this is a little, I just wanted to point out with this one that this is a little cross-pollination with the Ornament of Precious Liberation again, and we touched on that last week. Just that if you want more detail on this, because this is just like, okay, let's just do it. This is like a recipe that just says, like, mix everything together and put it in the oven. It's like, well, you actually need some details. Like, what do I mix together and how much of each thing? And so for the details, you can turn to the Ornament of Precious Liberation, also known as the Jewel Ornament, the chapter on the Paramita of Meditation, which we're currently doing in the Washington, D.C. Sangha is currently studying that. And after you isolate your body and your mind, according to Gampopa, then he spends some time addressing what the content of your meditation should be, and it's exactly this: identify your defects. So you're not just sitting down and doing some random thing. The best use of meditation, according to both Gampopa and Trungpa Rinpoche, is really look at your own mind. Like, what is my strongest mental affliction? Do I tend to get angry? Do I tend to have strong, like, wishes for things, like to have things or for things to be a certain way? That's like attachment or anger. Or is it ignorance? Or is it jealousy? Or is it pride? Like, really pay attention to your experience. And then in that chapter, he gives instructions for how to meditate to help tame each emotion. So if jealousy is your emotion, then you follow the instructions for jealousy, and you can incorporate that into your actual meditation. Anger, for example, if we find that we get angry and irritated a lot, then when we sit to meditate, the first thing we do could be to do a meditation on loving kindness. And that helps build up our loving kindness, like building up your immune system. Helps build up the loving kindness. And you do that repeatedly in all your meditation sessions. It doesn't have to be the only thing that you do in meditation, but you could start out each session with doing the classic loving kindness meditation or some taking and sending if anger is your problem. So if you want more on this, if you'd like to put this instruction into practice, which I strongly recommend, read the Paramita of Meditation, the Jewel Ornament. Be content with just enough food for sustenance, just enough clothing to protect yourself, and your practice will progress from day to day, month to month, and year to year. Those are big distractions for us, our food. We want just the right thing. We want it fancy. We want to go to this restaurant. We want to, just enough clothing. Like, obviously for us Westerners, the situation's different from 14th century living in a cave. You don't need much in the cave. We need a bit more here. But we spend an awful lot of time like shopping and, getting the next thing we need. And you can actually tame that a bit. You know, it is possible to to cultivate more and more contentment with what you already have, and then you can get things you need, but you're not always distracting yourself by noticing the faults with what you have and thinking, well, I need something better than this, or I need another thing. So that's how we adapt that instruction. Once you are free from all distracting conditions, your practice will bring you progress along the path. Again, that's how the verse unfolds. The dominoes just fall. We get the solitude. We start to practice and the dominoes just fall, and we're moving towards awakening instead of moving towards more confusion and more suffering. That is why all the yogins of the past wandered like beggars from one solitary place to another. Even a single month in a quiet and lonely place will be enough for your animosity to be replaced by a wish to benefit others. So if you really turn your mind towards the Dharma, even for a little while on a daily basis, this will happen. Your mind will start to turn, and you will more and more want to do that activity instead of wanting the distractions. I'm going to skip the next part. We talked about it a bit last week, but basically it's about thinking that we might be wasting our time, or shouldn't we be helping beings? We're bodhisattvas. Shouldn't we be out there helping beings, helping the homeless, helping stop wars, you know, picketing, whatever it is we can do? Shouldn't we be doing that? Isn't it a waste of time and sort of selfish to just be sitting and meditating? Well, Drom Tunpa and Atisha both said, actually, when your mind is really untamed and you live in turbulent times, you really need to remove yourself. In order to become really able to help, you need the isolation, you need the practice. So with us, we live in the world, we're not in a cave. He was talking to people like, yeah, it's okay to go live in a cave even though bad things are happening down here, because you will be able to help people so much better when you come back. For us, our lives are very mixed. We're sometimes practicing and sometimes out there where we can actually do actual physical and material things to help people. So we just don't want to lose sight of, like, yeah, it's okay to sit on the meditation cushion. It actually makes our help more effective. Don't let anybody tell you different, because there's a lot of people out there now sort of talking about engaged Buddhism. It's already engaged. It's in the jewel ornament. We help people. We do whatever they need. But you also have to have the meditation piece. Otherwise, we can help people in ways that are not helpful. Yes, sorry, Patrick.
You read that as about the one that starts this decadent age.
Mm-hmm.
You read that as temporary instructions, that you would go do that for a while and then come back better prepared?
He's talking to people who are going off to live in a cave. Nobody lived in a cave. Well, very few people lived in a cave their whole life. Kala Rinpoche did 12 years. And then he came back and he engaged with people. So here we're talking about a different time and a different place than where we are right now. So we adapt this to our own circumstances. I don't think that the takeaway from this is we need to spend 24/7 in our meditation space and not go out there and help people. We have to fit it into our life, but we need that piece of it. And that's what I take away from this, is that we need to make time for this piece of it where we do isolate ourselves. And terrible things could be going on out there, but we still need to find some of that time to center ourselves. Does that answer your question somewhat?
Yeah, but it seems to me like it's rather advice to go immerse yourself. Not just do it a few hours.
Like I said, it's different. It's a different time and place. He's 14th century Tibet. These people are actually even earlier, like 10th century India and Tibet. So they didn't live in the 21st century in the West.
Really?
So we have to read a lot of instructions that way, like, see them through the filter of our own culture. And you can reach your own conclusion about that, but that's my take on it. Yeah, they're not speaking to us. They're speaking to monastics, largely.
I mean, it's the text of the day, so it's speaking to us. I mean, through the book and through what you're teaching, I mean, I'm just trying to see if it really says you can do, if it's instructions for a daily practice, or if it's a suggestion that times are so bad, you should go immerse yourself and hope you can have a, you know, a stronger mind to help through your mind and not through your protest.
I think he is saying that. I think that's a good point. He is saying that. And if we can do that, if we can go and do a 3-year retreat, it's encouragement to do that. If we could go and meditate for 12 years in a cave, it's encouragement to do that. That's like the best way to develop ourselves so that we can help people more effectively. But they didn't have the option of a meditation corner in your house, and you went, that's not how people practiced back then. So we have an option that they didn't have, and we can use that option. But I think you're right that the literal reading of it is go away, like just go away and immerse yourself in practice. And if we can do that, I think that's a fabulous thing to do. I don't think that it's a wrong instruction or an inapplicable instruction. But most of us can't really do that. We might get the 3 years if we're really lucky.
Okay.
I'm gonna go on because we just got a few more minutes. And I want to save the last 5 minutes for meditation and prayers. Okay, I'm going to skip some. So I wanted to go down to the bottom of, for us, it's page 67 if you have the book. This sentence that John brought up last week, we didn't have time to look at it. The essence of learning is reflection, and the essence the essence of reflection is meditation. So that's those three components of the first practice: study or learning, contemplation or reflection, and meditation. Anybody have any insights on what that means? The essence of learning is reflection, and the essence of reflection is meditation. I don't have an answer for you. I think that, I mean, I've pondered that a bit, and I think it's something to contemplate. So my question, which I put on the blog as a contemplation, is like, if that doesn't really make sense to us, if we don't really understand what is meant by that, this is Dingo Chense Rinpoche speaking, how do we come to understand it? Like, what would you do? Would you just like go, I don't get it, and you just go on? Or might you come back to it from time to time or work with it in some way? And we don't have to have an answer to that either, but that's my way, is like, I would just come back to it. Like, I might put it on an index card and have it in a place where I would see it and run across it. The essence of learning is reflection. The essence of reflection is meditation. And just let it sink in. Maybe wrestle with it in contemplation occasionally. Think it to myself before doing some shine. Anyway, it's like with emptiness. It's like something that may be too big for our mind or doesn't quite fit in yet, but you don't have to give up on it. I think there's some important meaning there. And I can work with it backwards, sort of like learning leads to contemplation. Like without the study, you don't, there's nothing to contemplate. And without the contemplation, well, it's a little bit less definite there, but the contemplation also leads to meditation because you exhaust your thoughts about it after a while. Like you can't think about it anymore. So then you could just sit. Deirdre, did you have anything to say on that? I see you nodding.
Yeah, that's how I felt. And I thought how beautiful how it like dovetailed from one into the other. That's how it felt for me. Yeah. And it just felt, I loved the phrase. And it felt like how one leads to the next.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. That word essence, though, I'm not sure I quite understand that one. But Tibetans use that word more than we use that word. I think they use that word sometimes where we wouldn't use the word essence, so it becomes confusing. I'm still pondering that one. It's sort of on my, yes, Marilyn, I'm unmuting you now.
Well, if I think about essence, first I thought about it as bringing out a washcloth and getting the water out of it. But then I really think like it's just distilling something, where you have something and you just distill it down to its, you know, most core whatever. So that's where I came to it, to like essence is the distillation. I don't think that's what essence means a lot of the times.
Yeah. But it's the word that's used here, and that's because it's the Tibetan word that's used. So I'm not sure the translator is getting what would convey the meaning to us in English. But I like what you just said. Yes, Anne, I'm going to unmute you.
What it says to me is, in order to really learn something, to have it become part of you, it's sort of like the Dharma says, you have to think about it, tear it apart like you do with the Dharma, like gold. You have to test it. And that's the reflection part. And then it becomes part of your whole being and you're learning. To me, that's what it means by essence. And the same with the meditation. You can reflect, but it's not until you're silent and you let it sift down, as you said, into your being that it becomes part of you, really.
Yeah. I think that goes with Marilyn's washcloth. Like you're sort of wringing the essence out of it. Like you wring the essence out of study by reflecting on it. And you wring the essence out of reflection, out of the conceptuality by going straight to the non-conceptual meaning of it. I think we might be getting somewhere here. Deidre, did you have something else?
Yeah, just another thing that reminded me that they're not separate. That's what I think essence means, is that they are done independently, but they're not separate.
Excellent. All right, we're going to move on now, but I appreciate everybody's thoughts on that. All right. We're going to leave Dingo Chensei's commentary now, and I actually don't have Ken's with me, but people who have the book can read it. The main point I got from Ken McLeod on this one, I think, is that it's something we have to make happen. And I talked about that in my blog update. It's not going to happen by itself. So he said we have to simplify our life. Just don't take on stuff you don't have to take on. Don't keep adding more distraction and keep adding more busyness. Elective things, like maybe you could let go of those. And that's how you make the time and the space for the solitude from which everything else unfolds. I'm going to just share with you in closing Kenpo Tsultrum Jamso Rinpoche's, just one paragraph from his commentary on this. He's like the godfather of the 37 practices for most of us because we first learned it from him. And this is just a distillation of the meaning of the whole verse. He says, when you are alone in an isolated place, distractions caused by outside objects wane, while virtuous activities of practicing the genuine Dharma naturally grow. Solitude clears the mind, sharpens the awareness. From this mental clarity, certainty and deep trust in the Dharma are born. Male and female bodhisattvas do well to occasionally seek solitude. I can hear him saying that. all right, so let's see what else I have. So for next week, I will get the update up sooner this week, and it'll have some suggested contemplations in it. We're going to go on to verse 4 next week. But carry the contemplations with you if you can. Keep noticing as your experience unfolds, you know, in your moment-to-moment life, keep noticing it at the level, your reactions at the level of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, because that's the first spark of emotion before it develops into a full-blown emotional affliction. If we catch it at pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, which is the second skanda, it's how we respond to every stimulus in our lives, we learn something from that. We don't necessarily stop the emotional reaction, but we see something. We start to see something. So keep looking at that if you can remember to do that. Keep contemplating, like on a daily basis, like if you're having trouble getting to your Dharma practice, like, am I not getting to it because I genuinely am too busy? Or am I not getting to it because it's not just really what I want to do right now? And I think that's a really helpful contemplation. And you can apply the four thoughts to that. Especially impermanence. And as you study verse 4 on your own, reading the commentary and all that, ask yourself, what is there to contemplate here? Like, what do I need to think about here? It's impermanence. It's an easy one. We're all very familiar with that one. So I'd like to close by chanting the prayers one more time together. And then after we chant the prayers, we're just going to meditate. So this is a suggestion that I have that you can, it's an optional suggestion, but one way that you can meditate, like if you do have trouble fitting Dharma into your life and you're not sitting and doing Chenrezig or Lundra or whatever you have, or a session of Shina every day, you could make your meditation like this. Chant the verse. Chant all the verses or chant the verse we're working on. Just sit down, chant the verse, and then you could contemplate a little bit if you want to, if you have time, or you could just go straight to meditation from that. Chant the verse and then let your mind rest and see what settles around that. And you can let your mind rest in open awareness. You can let your mind rest in taking and sending. You can let your mind rest in following the breath, like whatever kind of meditation works for you. But start out with something like one of the verses. I like that kind of meditation when I'm studying something. So let's chant them together. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat to navigate samsara's endless sea and set myself and other beings free, for that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To give up all my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my Dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rinpa clarifies, and certainty in Dharma dawns and thrives. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So we'll just let our minds come to rest for about a minute. So this is one option for practicing at home. You could take the verse that you're working with. You could read it at the beginning, meditate for a few minutes. You could read it again as you need to. If it's helpful, you could read it a few times and meditate a little bit after each one. Or you could just use it at the beginning one time and go from there with your meditation, wherever it leads you. All right, so we would have chanted verse 4, but I actually didn't print it out. Now, I'm putting the verses on my blog, but it's probably also helpful if I continue to send you this sheet, right? The file that has all the verses in it. So I'll do that. But I'm not doing the diacritic marks anymore unless somebody needs them. And if somebody does need them, please let me know. I think we maybe all have the tune now. So we will do our closing prayers on our prayer sheet. And again, as last week, I got 10 or 15 minutes if anybody wants to hang around and, you know, talk after class, but we're officially over after the prayers, so anybody that needs to leave can leave. So dedication of merit. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, From this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And letting our minds come to rest just for a moment. And we're done. And I want to apologize. Like, there are times, one of my failings as a teacher is that I do sometimes get a little pressured by time because I'm looking ahead. And I'm always looking for that balance because I really like the discussion. So I'm working on that. I just sometimes have a concept of what I want to fit into the class. And so I sometimes feel a little rushed. I hope that doesn't come across too much, but anyway. All right, bye to anybody who needs to leave. And I'm going to unmute everybody in case you want to stay and hang out for a little while.
Lama.
Wow, somebody's got things going on. I'm going to mute. Somebody's got a TV or something. Okay. I see. It's Fanny. Fanny, I'm just going to mute you. Okay, just because of the background noise. But you can type anything. How's everybody doing?
Good.
How are you feeling about the class? Any feedback that you would like to share?
I have a question.
Yes, John.
That screen share that you did, is that inside your blog? Because I didn't see that whole list of them all together. It seems separated.
No, that's just a file. And every week I've sent you the updated file, but I haven't done it for verse 4 yet. I will do that probably today. Did that answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the one piece of email that I think we'll need to do every week as email. And I'm just going to put the audio up on the blog, unless anybody needs it sent as email. If it's helpful to have it as email, it's no problem for me to do that. Mm-mm. Okay. Anyway, please, you can privately give me feedback by email as well if there's something you need that, or any comment you want to make or whatever, or if you have a question in between classes, I'm available by email.
I really love this. I really appreciate it.
So glad you could join us, Dan.
Yeah, and hopefully I can do it next Thursday as well. So. Yeah.
Well, our format is extremely informal. People come when they can. It's summer, and people have things they have to go do. So you just come when you can. And I post on the blog every week the notes for people who miss. I'm really good. How's Clem? Is she still up?
Yeah, she's going to take a little later nap today.
Yeah, okay. Dan and Clem and I sometimes go for a walk in the botanical garden next door to my house.
Oh, nice.
Very fun. Very fun, two-year-old.
We'll do that again sometime.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I just wanted to say that as a teacher, your techniques are right on. I mean, I'm speaking as a former teacher.
Right.
The techniques of implanting things that you're going to see ahead in the future, and that gives you the learner the capacity to sort of go, wait a minute, I heard a little bit about that before, so therefore, oh yeah, you've got something to hook the new knowledge onto. So that's only one of the things that you do that are really exemplary.
Mm-hmm. That'd be my Latin teaching background, I'm sure. Marilyn and I are both Latin teachers, among other things.
Wow. I did not.
I can terrorize a class of middle school boys. You're lucky that you're not that. I don't do it anymore, though. That's in the past, before I did that.
Before Dharma.
But there's these sort of hoodlum-y kind of kids, teenage kids in my neighborhood right now, and they pass my house sometimes, and I've had a couple of interactions with them, and I'm like, one of these days I'm going to be channeling the Latin teacher and you're going to be really sorry.
You live in a safe neighborhood, Lama?
Yeah, it's pretty safe. But we do get a lot of foot traffic, a fair amount of foot traffic. There's no sidewalks, but we still get a lot of foot traffic.
Weird.
Yeah. Well, mostly, I mean, people are fine, but there's just these two kids that, I don't know, they seem to have their eye on me a little bit. Maybe they just terrorize little old ladies. And they're not terrorizing. They're just a little bit, you know, I worry they vandalize my mailbox or something.